evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adesk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be here after the first segment of today's program. So let's get started with the market report for Thursday, February 9th, 2017. Well, we were having a good run in gold. We had a little bit of a setback today, and certainly Wall Street's three main indexes hit record intraday highs today after President Donald Trump said he would make a phenomenal tax announcement over the next 2 or 3 days. Lowering the overall tax burden on American business is big league, Trump said in a meeting with airline executives. We're going to be talking about that meeting in here just a little bit and about what those airline stocks did for the day after the big meeting and after the big announcement that there will be another big announcement in the next couple of weeks about some big tax cuts and so forth. But first, nothing big about gold today except a big it's not a big drop. It's 1040. We needed a little bit of a pullback here, and we got one today. So 1040 for gold to the downside at $1,231.60. Silver was down 11 cents at 1774. Platinum was down 1 at 1019. Palladium was up 1 at $774. The USDX today was up strong, 0.47 at 100.66. It was followed by crude up 0.71 at 53.05. And let's just see what the averages did today. The Dow Jones, well, didn't keep its high. 116 points. It was about 12:30, it was actually up 125 points, 126 points. Looking at 117, 20,172. The NASDAQ was up 32, 57.15, and the S&P was up 13 at 23.07. 10-year yield, that shot up a little bit, 0.04, 2.40%. The euro was 107. And the European markets, let's see what the European markets did, if it's even worth mentioning. They really didn't do anything at all. And it does seem, remember I've been mentioning the fear and greed index, and it does seem like greed is creeping back into the markets. Short memories people have. And that's one little trend there that'll, you know, that flips and flops in either direction for no rhyme or reason. And if somebody just says something, it's amazing how markets can move. But we're going to get back to the what Mr. Trump said today. As I mentioned, at about 12:30, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 125 points. 8 of the 11 major S&P sectors were higher. The S&P 500 Financial Index rose 1.3%. And it was on a track to snap a three-day losing streak. Now, Coca-Cola fell 2.3% after their forecast dropped in a full-year adjusted profit. The stock was the biggest drag on the Dow. Well, you know what happens when you have a drag on the Dow. They're going to replace you with one of their darlings because you have to keep that Dow going up. You can't have anyone in there that's negative. So we'll just have to see how long they're going to keep Coke, see if they're going to replace them with one of their darlings. And hey, Coke, if you can't keep up with the big boys in the Dow, the other 29 companies, well, we'll just have to see what happens. And I'm saying that as a little bit of a funny. They're not going to replace Coke because they were down and everybody else was up. But that's what they do. They replace the companies in the Dow to make sure to keep them, you know, keep those companies going higher, higher, and higher. You got to have that positive attitude across this country. Even as much as President Donald Trump Twitter sank 10%, almost 11% today. They reported lower advertising revenue in its last quarter. This, of course, is you think everybody would advertise because all the Trump buzz, it didn't drive growth except down. According to a new report from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, we're going to combine higher gold prices with rising bond yields. And they said this is a trend to watch to signal impending market volatility. Both the stock market crashes of 73, 74, and 87 were preceded by three quarters of rising bond yields and rising gold. I bet if you looked at some of the other market drops, like in the mid-90s and of course, 2008, 9, and 10, you'll probably have very similar connections with gold and yields. The thinking is that if interest rates and gold rise in tandem, it signals rising inflation, which led the Federal Reserve to increase its short-term interest rate targets. Rate hikes tend to be bad news for the economy and for stocks in particular. Well, you wouldn't know today, but of course, as I mentioned, one day does not make a trend. So the paper markets had a great day today. We had a little bit of a pullback. Great day to be adding some gold and silver to your portfolio. Specials have been adjusted to reflect very little change, actually, in the specials. And, of course, we'll still continue to have $2.45 over spot for the 1 ounce American Silver Eagles. And, again, these are the current year, the 2017s. I want to go back to, I mentioned that there was a meeting between the president and the airlines. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, but, you know, he's talking about deregulating the airlines along with tax, you know, decreases, but one of them is less regulations. My question is, does less regulation increase the risk of planes kind of falling out of the sky? I mean, I don't know. But anytime you eliminate regulations and they don't have to follow standard procedures or keep to a certain level, you know something is going to be compromised. And so again, I just ask, less regulation. I mean, some things do need to be regulated. So maybe we should ask Malaysian Airlines. But Mr. Trump told the U.S. airlines he would help them compete with foreign carriers, he said are subsidized by their governments, a crucial signal of White House support for a long-running industry campaign that began back in 2015. Mr. Trump said at the White House, "You've got a lot of competition." And his meeting today consisted of the nation's largest airlines, air freight companies, and airports. He said a lot of that competition is subsidized by governments, big league. Most of the major airlines, I think, except Delta, they're whining that $50 billion in government support have enabled three Persian Gulf carriers to compete unfairly. The airlines asked last week to meet with Secretary of State Tillerson to discuss their allegations against Emirates, PJSC, Qatar Airways. Well, my question is, well, these governments might be giving subsidies to the airlines, but I don't think any of them are $20 trillion in debt plus, if you include unfunded liabilities. So, so do we as a country that is basically bankrupt just continue to eliminate regulations, provide subsidies, provide makeovers so these corporations can be profitable or more profitable? Certainly the Saudis and the Persian Gulf carriers, you know, their governments, you know, they made billions of dollars off the petrodollar. So it's just like, everybody prospered over these past years except the U.S., and we went deeper and deeper in debt so all these other nations and countries could become better, more wealthier. But Trump continues. He said, and this is again to the airlines, to the carriers, he says, "You people are regulated probably as much as anybody. We're going to be announcing something, I would say, over the next 2 or 3 weeks that will be phenomenal in terms of tax and developing our aviation infrastructure. Well, we all know that the infrastructures of this country are just in such decay. Have you been to an airport lately? Last time I was in an airport, I was talking, we were on those little trains that cart you around to one place to another, to one terminal, so you can pick up a flight someplace else. And the flight crew, along with the pilot, was in the same little area that we were in, and we were talking to them, and all they complained about was they hated to fly to the States because it, because of these airports are in such poor condition. But what he talks about in terms of tax and developing infrastructure, the aviation, it sounds great. But again, my question is, who's going to pay for all this? The taxpayer got Mr. Trump elected. Now the taxpayer is going to have to pay twice. First to finance all the deregulations and subsidies, and then we'll have to pay again when the deregulations fail. I hope they don't fail. I hope it'll create jobs. I hope it can better the country. And when I hear of everyone talking about new great jobs and higher paying jobs, I mean, I don't want to sound negative. It's just a little bit of reality here. Maybe I should change the name instead of financial survival. It should be financial reality. I mean, I do hope this all works out for the better. But I know better. Just like we take Intel's announcement yesterday. It's kind of like the other side of the coin. And we're going to yesterday I mentioned we were going to talk about that article where Intel announced they were going to open a plant. The plant's already there. They're going to finish it off in the next couple of years, and they're going to hire 3,000 people. Intel has a great presence in that area. They hire lots of people. I believe they're number one. They're the number one employer in that area. So they're big there. They hire a lot of people, and they're going to hire 3,000 more. They're going to finish this plant. It's great. It's great for the community. But it was less than a year ago that Intel announced a layoff of over 12,000 people, 11% of its global workforce, up to 12,000 employees. That's a painful downsizing. And Intel wasn't doing any well because of the PC market. You know, they're kind of late into the game on all this connecting devices and cloud computing and, you know, all that stuff. So they're getting out of the PC market and going more into, you know, with what's happening today. And that changes so quick. But he said in an email a year ago that the CEO, Brian Zanich, said that after the restructuring, he's confident that they will emerge as a more productive company with broader reach and sharper execution. Intel CFO Stacy Smith said that half the workforce reduction, 6,000 people, will be accomplished by the end of this year. Now, that was 2016. So they restructured. So here we are, less than a year later. It hasn't even been a year when they made this announcement. Intel's cuts hits people across the business in all departments, but fell most heavily on a single category of one employee. A single category of an employee, and that's the older workers. People over 40 were 2.5 times more likely to lose their jobs than Intel employees under 40. And this is data Intel provided to employees in compliance with a federal order. Intel also offered buyouts to another 2,300 U.S. employees, again, primarily older workers, and early retirement packages to 3,400 other senior employees with an average age of 57. Intel's restructuring offers an inside look into the plight of older workers in corporate America. These are some of the most experienced and best paid professionals in every industry. But in a business world that changes fast, those traits often turn them into targets as employers are looking to reshape businesses and cut costs. A study last year by ARP found workers past the age of 55 often spend months seeking a new job after being laid off. University of California, Berkeley economist Claire Brown said employers these days, they want young workers and they want cheap workers. They can teach them. They're learning. They can learn the new skills. Well, old people can, or older people can too, but they're not cheap. So what do? These companies restructure, get rid of the older workers, get rid of the pensions, get rid of, you know, everything that they're going to have to pay, bring in these young workers who don't know any better, who thinks, you know, $13 an hour is a great wage. They're on their parents' policies until they're 26. So they're very cheap. Intel just can't keep making the stuff that they can't sell anymore. So it's not the fault of the older people. It's just poor planning on Intel. They couldn't keep up with the times, so they had to restructure. And it's not a coincidence. Last year when Intel began using stock grants as a performance measure to determine who gets laid off, older employers took the hit. The average age of an Intel worker is a little under 43, according to the documents obtained by the newspaper The Oregonian. The average age of the laid-off worker is nearly 48. As workers age, their chances of losing their jobs in April's layoffs increased. Intel was nearly 8 times more likely to lay off workers over 60 as it was to lay off those under 30. So you're going to hear talk of high-paying jobs, but the reality, they're not high-paying jobs. They cut their wages in half. I was reading the article where were people that were making $125,000. They all got cut. Do you think they're going to be offering those same wages? No. And maybe in today's climate, you know, maybe $15 an hour is a good wage anymore. But I don't think it's the wages that so many Americans are expecting to receive. I think we have, maybe we're just looking at these things a little bit differently. We have to keep reality. And reality says, folks, you know, if you're going into your retirement age, you better get positioned. The markets are primed to drop. They can't continue at these levels. You'll be the first to go if you're approaching retirement age. So get those dollars out of there. Get some of them protected with gold and silver. And make sure you give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Alfred and James will be with you right after these few short commercials.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, for some of the best videos, podcasts, articles, thinking on economics, geopolitics. But as James says, there's no gossip, there's no fashion, and there's no sports. So if you're looking for those three subjects, that Corbett Report won't probably be your best choice. But if you're trying to understand what's happening in the world right now, one of the best places you can visit is thecorbettreport.com. Hello, James.
Hello. Hello again.
Yep. Hello again. We're talking about Donald Trump a little bit. There was a report in one of the newspapers that last night, Donald Trump asked his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, at 3 a.m. in the morning. He allegedly called at 3 a.m. in the morning to ask him whether the economy was better off with a strong dollar or a weak dollar. Now, all by itself, that question, if this is a true story, and you know, who can say anymore, but it appears to me to be a valid story. If it is, it indicates that Trump is having second thoughts about his notion that the dollar is too strong and it needs to be weakened. What do you think is best for the U.S. economy? A strong dollar, a weak dollar? Are either one of those selections a good selection?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the fundamental question is who should be deciding that, and in what way should that be decided? I mean, do we need a government to set a dollar policy? Do we need a central bank that will, you know, in the case of the Federal Reserve, pump in trillions of liquidity and or take it out of the system as they feel is needed in order to keep inflation at a certain rate or to keep unemployment at a certain rate? Who should be managing the economy, I think, is the fundamental question. And I think the real answer is no one. I think there should be free markets. But in the case of that we have, where the U.S. government obviously does think of itself as the manager of the economy, and here is a man who quite obviously thinks of himself as a businessman who can control every aspect of his business. I'm sure that's the way that he's looking to try to run the U.S. economy. And so the question is, strong dollar or weak dollar? Of course, both have their pluses and minuses. It depends what kind of economy you're looking to have and what role you are looking to take in the international monetary order. Given that you have the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, and given that there will never, within this time period, within this era, within this context and this system of the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, you will never have a lack of demand for U.S. dollars, then the answer would seem to be, well, print as many as you need. It doesn't really matter to what extent you run the U.S. dollar down. There will still be people who will be eager to take U.S. debt. And to the extent that the U.S. dollar is inflated away, well, that gives you an export advantage for export products. But the question is, what is America exporting these days? That's a very good question. Now, if Trump is trying to turn the economy around and make it into a domestic production-based economy for domestic consumption, then the question of strong and weak dollar does not, at least in that economic sense, does not have as big a deal, is not as big a problem. Then it becomes more a question of, well, okay, so what raw materials are you importing and from where? And if you have a strong dollar, you can import them more cheaply. And you don't have to worry so much about export markets. So there's a lot of considerations that would go in. But then, of course, there's also the geopolitical and monetary aspects to this, which have, I won't say have nothing to do, but are tangential to the economic issues and what that means for the average person in working the economy.
Well, when we talk about lack of demand for U.S. dollars, what does that compare How does that relate to the push that seems to be building in the world for a cashless society? Can the dollar, we've had, I think it was Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury. I think he was advocating back six weeks ago, he said, we need to get rid of the $100 bill. What happens to all the $100 bills that are tucked away in people's mattresses in India and Africa? I mean, their $100 bill has been their form of savings in much of the world. If we get rid of the $100 bill, what happens to them? Do they become worthless? And is that tolerable? And can the dollar remain as the world reserve currency if it cancels its $100 bills?
Yes, this is an interesting question. I think it would still, but it would certainly change that dynamic. And as you say, the vast majority of specifically $100 currency units are kept overseas, are not domestic. So it is forms of savings in a lot of different countries that do not have that perception of stability in their own currencies. So that would have a significant effect. It depends, I suppose, how that is done, how it is phased out. If it's demonetized all at once, and I mean, I couldn't imagine that they would say those are just simply not valid anymore. I mean, there would be a period whereby you would be able to exchange them for, you know, valid currency. So it's a question of what access, you know, people in rural India, for example, would have to that mechanism. And if they don't have direct access to it, then I'm sure a black market would develop for them to offload the bills at a premium in order to get something out of them. But it would cause some disruption that way for sure. And it would, I think, have an effect on the extent to which the world perceived the U.S. dollar, at the U.S. currency, as the kind of world, the world bedrock. You don't want to be rocking the boat too much when you're the boat that sets the tide for everyone else. That's a strained analogy, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, to be the world reserve currency, you have to project that stability, and to be demonetizing base currency notes is kind of a dramatic move. But one could see it certainly happening, and obviously there are already floating ideas about this in Europe and elsewhere about the 500 euro note and what have you. So we're going to see it happening.
India's wiped out their two largest notes. I think it was 1,000 rupees and 500 rupees. Pardon me?
They replaced them with new notes. So
have they replaced them already? They didn't initially. It was promised, and I don't know whether they are actually replacing them now or not, but it was promised they'd be replaced, but it didn't seem to happen, at least in short order.
Well, it was the typical Indian bureaucratic nightmare where the printers had been assured that they had until the end of the year to get the new notes ready, but then suddenly Prime Minister Modi announced it on live TV in November, and suddenly they were a couple of months short of the goal. And so there was a huge confusion and headache, and they've been scrambling to print. And I just saw that they're going to be allowing, I think, 50,000 rupees of withdrawals in the new currency per week, I believe, from February 20th, and then no restrictions from March 13th or something like that. So they're still scrambling to keep up. But one would imagine that within the coming months, they will have that finally sorted, and the new bills will be there to replace what was taken out.
What was the purpose of replacing the existing bills, the ones that had been there, if they're just going to replace them with new bills? I mean, I can understand the purpose if they were going to replace the existing bills, and they were going to replace them with plastic debit cards, credit cards, whatever, but some sort of plastic currency where you can swipe your little plastic card, and then you get your whatever it is you're trying to purchase. But what's the purpose of changing, getting rid of these bills and putting in new paper bills?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Satya Sagar, a commentator from India, who has a few articles up on this that I'll direct your listeners to. They can go watch my interview, or they can read his own articles, including one called Death by Demonetization that was posted up at kefila.online back in November. And he pointed out at least four different reasons that this would be beneficial to Modi and the Indian government. The first would be to basically recapitalize Indian banks. All of this paper cash that was sitting out there, stuffed under mattresses and what have you, you know, hiding from the taxman, will be, as a result of this, have been flowing through the banks to to get the new notes. And a lot of that ends up getting parked in banks, because now that it's declared, there's no point in hiding it under your mattress so much. So it has helped to recapitalize Indian banks. It has increased the government's cash flow, because a significant portion of the cash being held has been this so-called black money. This is a term they use in India to talk about money that is not taxed, that is outside of the system. Well, obviously, having to declare it as they turn in their old notes and get new notes means a flush of new tax revenue for the Indian government. It's also, there's a political agenda to this as well, because a lot of that black money that's being kept outside of the purview of the government is used in a lot of political campaigns. So the funding, this could be a key way to cut off that black money funding for the political opponents of Narendra Modi and the current government. But perhaps most interestingly, the idea that has been talked about of India going cashless. And this is tied into that in a number of different ways. One of them was pointed out by a German analyst called Norbert Herring, who had an article a couple of months ago about this, where he was talking about how U.S. aid had helped to sponsor a program called Catalyst, Inclusive Cashless Payment Partnership, talking about how they were going to boost the cashless payment system infrastructure in India. And that was launched 4 weeks before the demonetization took place.
Do you think Modi did a good job? It came off as it seemed to be botched so badly you had to suppose that it was just an idiotic idea to begin with. Do you think it's going to turn out in retrospect that India has done a pretty good job of replacing existing currencies with a new and improved currency that is not... It's apparently allergic to mattresses. You can't stuff mattresses with a new currency. They make it with fiberglass so it itches, perhaps. I'm not sure. But is this a good... Is it going to turn out well for India, or is this a botched idea?
Well, I guess there's a few different ways you could measure that. I mean, is this going to turn out well politically for Modi? That's a good question. I think it was deeply unpopular at the time, but depending on how the perception of all of this is manipulated, people might think, oh, you know, everything's better now that that black money has been taken care of, and now the Indian government has more money to play with. So it could theoretically turn into a political positive for him, but either way, he had quite a bit of political capital to spend, as it were, and I think he might have just spent it there. So the question is, does he get what he wants out of this? More broadly, is this good for India? I think ultimately this is really about fostering that cashless payments system infrastructure in India, where we've seen, as a direct result of this, cashless payment systems, mobile payment firms, Paytm and other companies like that have seen huge boosts in customers since this demonetization. Again, people who were keeping cash out of the system and now are forced to declare it, well, they might as well just hop on the new cashless payment systems, and that's even easier, especially when there's that liquidity crunch caused by the fact there aren't enough bills of these new bills to go around. So everyone's hopping on to these cashless payment systems. I think that ultimately that's going to give a lot more people access to the banking system. People even in rural India who wouldn't necessarily have a bank account, but now actually can transact through their smartphones and other things that increasingly a larger percentage of the population actually does have access to. But with that, of course, comes the biometric ID control grid, which is a very much a part of this. In fact, just in the last couple of weeks, the Indian government has announced they're going to be launching a new feature to the smart ID cards that they've been handing out over the last few years, where they've been trying to put 1.1 billion people into their biometric ID system, scanning their fingerprints and their irises. They've just announced they're going to be linking that up to a payment system. So soon you'll be able to just swipe your finger to pay for this or that. And I think we know where that's going. And I think ultimately it's the perfect panopticon, where the government will see every transaction that takes place in the economy.
And you'll be taxed on everything you do as soon as you do it. And you'll probably be taxed on everything you save. If you don't spend it, you'll be taxed on your savings. And if you do spend it, you'll be taxed on your spending. The government is out there to get as much as it possibly can. But the one thing you can say about this is apparently Modi has succeeded in pulling this currency that had been squirreled away and put it back into the economy, and that should have increased the money supply, and that should have stimulated India's economy to some measurable degree. And it may be that the people are saying, hey, this is working for me. I'm making more than I was, so I'm pretty pleased with Mr. Modi. You suppose that's true?
It could be, and there's a logic to that, but the facts don't necessarily go in line with that, in fact, because of the economic disruption caused by the taking out of these notes and the fact that there was so few people who were able to get access to actual cash during this period. Mm-hmm. The Tamil Nadu governor actually came out recently to say that this is actually decreased tax revenue because there's less economic activity going on because everyone's just trying to scramble to do anything. Sort of economic transactions, despite the fact they don't have this new cash. So, at least in the short term, it's actually decreased tax revenue, at least for certain parts of India. And so, it's not necessarily all as peachy sunshine and rainbows as the Indian government would like. Which leads me to believe this is even more so about that biometric ID cashless payment system than it is about the tax revenue itself.
You're living in the south. Western portion of Japan, isn't that true?
Yes, to the extent that south and north and west and east have. I mean, it's a small country, but yes, on the western side of the main island, yeah.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because Fukushima, as I understand it, is in the northeast. And there's a report that Fukushima is becoming more dangerous right now. Is that report exaggerated, or are we going to see even more radioactive waste pouring into the Pacific Ocean? And we've got about a minute till we take a break here.
All right. Well, in a minute or less. To answer your question, Fukushima is about 400 miles away from where I'm living. And what has just been found is that inside the reactor number one, we've seen the highest radiation reading since the whole meltdown scenario started. And this has been determined by examining video from inside the reactor and looking at the radiation exposure that the video has been subject to. They found 530 sieverts of radiation. Just to put that in perspective, that would kill any human being within a matter of seconds or minutes. It's an extremely high level of radiation, and they don't know precisely why it's gotten to that point right now.
Oh, that's good news. We have a problem, but we don't even know why. How are we going to fix a problem that we don't understand? We'll talk about that when we return to Financial Survival in just a moment. A couple of commercials, and I'll be back with my guest, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Alfred Adusk here with my guest, James Corbett from the CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We were talking about Fukushima and apparently an increase in radiation for reasons that we don't understand. Does anyone have any understanding of how much it might increase?
Well, it's not necessarily an increase. It's just the first time they've detected this particular radiation reading level. And basically the story, as reported by Kyodo, is that they took images of a remote through a remote-controlled camera, and they found a 2-meter hole in the metal grating under the pressure vessel that is in the reactor's primary containment vessel. And so that hole may or may not be where some of the actual core material melted through. They still don't know precisely where the core material is lying, but it could certainly be that they are now detecting actual core material itself, and that could explain the 530 sieverts. Within a functioning nuclear reactor, you would see several thousand sieverts per hour of radioactivity, so it certainly could be an indication that they're finding the fuel itself. And so it wouldn't be necessarily surprising if that's what that is. But again, this is inside the reactor itself. So they're still exploring, you know, with an aim to ultimately removing the fuel and making everything better again. But I think they're very much a long way off from that. And things like this, where they suddenly discover hundreds of sieverts per hour, it's certainly puts hampers in that effort, because obviously no human could come anywhere near that.
What about robots? I've heard that you made the comment that 500 or more, 500 sieverts or more would be enough to kill man, woman in just a matter of minutes, if I understood you correctly. But one of the big surprises is that the robots, they send in mechanical devices to take a look and see what's going on, and they are also crippled. Turns out that their circuitry is subject to degradation by radiation. So what about the robots? Are they able to go in there and explore?
They do have robots that are capable of withstanding exposure of up to 1,000 sieverts. So they estimate that if this is 530 sieverts, and the method that they're using to estimate that that radiation level, it's not a direct detection. Again, this is from digital interference on the camera itself. So there's a plus minus 30% margin of error in that reading. So it could be down more like 400, it could be upwards of 600. But anyway, in that range, they would expect the robot to be able to withstand at least 2 hours operating in that environment. So they are going to be sending more robots in to, or a new robot in to try to see if they can probe this in greater detail. But it will not last very long. A couple of hours of activity is all they'll be able to get out of it.
Speaking of robots, I saw a report in the newspaper today, or one of the news media, one of the news outlets, that a factory in China has replaced much of its employees with robots, and they're able to use 90% less people. And the result has been an increase in productivity of 250% and 80% less defects in their product. Now, when you see those kinds of numbers, is there anything that can withstand the economic imperative to install more robots? They've got to be less expensive, and they make a better product. Is there any way that this can be resisted? Should it be resisted? And what are we going to do if we don't resist it?
And let me tell you an interesting story that might seem unrelated, but I'm reading right now a ridiculously voluminous biography of the Beatles. It was written by Mark Lewisohn, who is considered the foremost historian of the Beatles in the world, and he's writing a three-volume biography of them right now, and he's in the midst of it. He's been writing it for
years. The Rise and Fall of the Beatles is the...
Pretty
much.
What
we have here?
Uh-huh. Yes, and so the first volume has been released, and the first volume covers up until the end of 1962, so before Beatlemania even takes place. The trade version of that is an 800-page volume, but I have the extended special edition that is 1,700 pages. So it covers basically the mid-1950s up until 1962. But the beauty of this biography is that it is telling the story in the context of the world they were living in and what was happening at that time. And one of the things that was in there recently that really stuck out to me was at one point Paul McCartney was he was doing a day job as a manual laborer at a coil winding facility, and when it was still up in the air whether or not he would, you know, commit full time to the Beatles. Obviously we know which way he ended up going, but it was talking about the economic conditions at factories like that and basically the stagnation of British industry because of the labor's intransigence at the idea of automation or anything that would decrease the amount of manual labor that was required, and of course would mean layoffs for people. And it is the conundrum, because obviously there is no doubt, no one can deny that factories will be more efficient and thus create greater profit and more money for the owners of the factories for sure with automation. And yet, you cannot dispute that there will be real economic hardship for the people who fall through those cracks, the people who get laid off as a result of that. Now, you can, as a society, as England did to a large extent in the mid-20th century, try to forestall that, and you can have extremely strong labor organizations that basically that go on strike at the drop of a hat and stop that progress from happening. But all that means is, that country, yes, sure, England might forestall the inevitable, but other countries will absolutely allow themselves to go through that process, will break the strikes, will break up the labor organizations, will go ahead with the automation. The only question is where it will take place. And in an increasingly globalized world with global supply chains, do you think factory workers care, factory owners at all care where they source that their goods from? Whether they have to build their factory in China or Malaysia or wherever, whatever country offers the best general framework for their laws will be the one that they go to. So, for example, when it comes to Trump and protectionist policies in America and what they're going to do to stop this type of, you know, replacement of human workers, it will be done elsewhere in the world. And those where it is done elsewhere will receive the economic benefits that redound to those who are willing to go for the automation at whatever expense, social and otherwise. I think it's inevitable, and I think we're already seeing it. And I don't think there's a way to put brakes on this process.
I don't think there's a way to put brakes on it either, especially we're talking about this report I mentioned. This is China. We're not talking about a place that's overrun by high wages. These people are already working for minimum wage to begin with, and yet 90% of them are being replaced in this one factory with an increase of 250% productivity and 80% less defects. Now, this is not just a curiosity. This is something, if you're running a factory selling widgets and I'm running a factory selling widgets and you install robots in yours, you have such a competitive advantage. There is no option for me other than to install my own set of robots. I can't continue to work with people if you're using robots. And again, this is China. If they can get rid of 90% of labor in China, it seems obvious to me that they can get rid of 90% or more labor in the United States or Great Britain and so on. This is a revolution, and it's moving so quickly. I mean, economic imperatives are so enormous that you must move or you're going to be out. You're going to be done. Take your factory and shut the doors. Sell the bricks. You know, hire labor to chip the concrete off the bricks or the cement off the bricks, and maybe you can sell the bricks and capture a little money for your plant, but that will be the end of it. This isn't a process. How long do you think it's going to take before the public is seriously aware of the threat that robots pose? And when I say threat, means you're not going to have a job. Maybe you will, but the average man will not have a job. He may have a welfare system that's going to support him, and he can kick back and just play on his Xbox all day. But will that generate psychological hardships? You mentioned economic hardships. What about psychological hardships? Can man get by without working?
It's going to be interesting to find out, because I think we are going to find out inevitably.
Yeah, no.
And just as context, I did say at the end of every year, myself and James Evan Pilato, we do a weekly news show called New World Next Week. At the end of each year, we pick a trend for the coming year that we think will define the trend of the year. And for 2017, I picked the trend of the rise of the robots. I really do think this is going to be increasingly something that comes to the forefront of political attention and the attention of the sort of average workers out there as we start to see more stories like this one. I'm not sure it's necessarily this year that everything is going to come to a head, but in the coming years, there's going to have to be some serious societal discussion of this issue, where it's only been sort of gestured at up to this point. And that's why you're starting to see the conversation about universal basic income, the idea of governments just paying everyone a certain amount of money every year, and then, you know, if you can make more on top of that, great. If not, it'll be enough for you to live on. It will be very interesting to see who tries to implement that and in what way and what strings come attached to that. But I am extremely dubious that will provide a different way of organizing the society and the world than we've seen up to this point in a way that will satisfy everyone. And the question, Can people live without work? I don't think so. I mean, it's maybe just a question of what we define work and what will come along to replace that. And to be fair, there are some people on the other side that say, we've seen this scare so many times over the past century or two that the end of work as we know it and all of this, and it's never come to pass. I think this is a difference in kind in terms of what we're seeing right now with the automation, but there are people who will say, there will be people to program the robots and that'll be the new jobs and the new economy.
They've already got robots, if I understand correctly, that are writing their own software. Now, I don't know that they're even going to need you or me to program the robots. I think our only option is perhaps we can all become rock stars. Right? Get a guitar. Maybe that's where the big money is. Invest in guitars. It will be one of the things that the robots... How long will it be before robots can play the guitars as well as... conventional rock star. Do you have any idea?
Well, there was a story from last year about an AI system that had created a song, or so they said. And when you read into the story, it wasn't... I think they overhyped it and the role of the AI in creating the song. But I think that is coming. I think we do see those types of trends developing. And as you say, it's not just that this is taking place quickly. It's increasingly taking place more and more quickly. The acceleration is accelerating.
That's exactly right.
It is an exponential trend. So the things that are coming, even in the next few years, I think will be quite amazing. And I always like to think back to even 10, 15 years ago, the idea of a smartphone would have almost been a magical, incredible technology to have that in your
hand.
Now we take it... Exactly. Now we take it for granted. Can you imagine what we'll be taking for granted 10 or 15 years from now?
It is unimaginable. Do you know of anyone that you think can accurately imagine what's likely to happen 15 years from now? I mean, to me, it's hard. Can anyone really give us a reliable prediction what's going to happen 5 years from now or 3 years from now? Who knows what Trump is going to do next week?
Right. Well, maybe DARPA will be able to let us in on the technology they have sealed up in the bowels of the Pentagon there, 50 years ahead of anything else we've seen commercially. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that things are actually much more developed than what we ultimately get as end users of this technology. So someone knows what we're going to be seeing in a few years, I imagine.
Well, they may have an idea, but this is, again, the difference. You said this is different from, in the past they had sabotage. The world is derived from throwing your sabots, your wooden shoes, into Dutch manufacturing facilities, maybe the 1600s, I don't remember what century, but the people were afraid that they were going to take their jobs, so they threw their shoes in the machinery and jammed up the machines, and they called it sabotage. Back then, yeah, this problem has always been facing us, but never at this velocity. We could adjust. New technology, yeah, it would come, but we had enough time to adjust. I don't think we're going to have time to adjust on this. I don't even think most people are capable of the adjustment. Yeah. This isn't just learning how to use a new backhoe. These are things with software that we aren't going to be able to understand. The average person will not be able to comprehend or deal with. And then what?
And then even if you do adjust, I mean, think of the adjustment that had to take place because of the Industrial Revolution. It made the world from a predominantly rural agrarian society into a predominantly urban society. More people live in cities now than live in rural areas for the first time in human history. The incredible societal and cultural changes that take place as a result of these technological revolutions cannot be underestimated, and one can imagine how much more amplified that process will be as we live through the robot revolution.
Especially with populations as large as they are. That's another part of the equation, but we'll have to leave that for another time because we're out of time. So thanks for being on the program, James. As always, enjoyed talking to you. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, and I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd the producer, and James Corbin. Bye.
I work all night, I work all day, I pay the bills I have to pay. Payments fast. And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my